I'm going to talk about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I have the Blade Runner version. This is what I assign my students because it costs about half of what the one that says Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep on it. And all I have to endure is a bunch of papers that say, you know, Philip K. Dick writes in Blade Runner. So, I have been teaching this book to classes for about 6 years. I've had a wonderful experience doing it. And what I'd like to do today is just kind of give you the standard lecture that I give my freshman students. So for some of you, you may look for something slightly more highbrow. You might want to know some of the more esoteric stuff from this book. But I hope that what I'm going to provide for you is a good overview of what I think is happening in this book. And I think this is one of the books that I can kind of assume that we've all read, since it is a primary canonical Philip K. Dick text. So let's start by taking the quiz that I give my students. What device do Deckard and his wife Aran argue about at the beginning of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Yes, please.
The mood organ.
Yes, but except that it's the Penfield mood organ. And I'd like to talk about that for a little bit. The device is named after a man whose name was Wilder Penfield. Just so happens that Wilder Penfield was my grandmother's uncle. And I actually know quite a bit about him. One of the most fascinating things about him was that he was one of the first successful brain surgeons. In fact, he was the first person to ever remove a tumor from a patient's brain and have that person survive. This is in the 19-teens and early 20s. There is no MRI, there is no x-ray. The way that they knew that somebody had a brain tumor was they would have facial paralysis, dementia, drooling, seizures, good stuff like that. What Wilder Penfield developed as a treatment is rather creepy. He would have the patient lie down on a table, operating table, awake. And he would have their brain exposed. Now, I would imagine that they used some kind of local anesthetic to crack open the skull. Maybe they used the cranial screw top method from Steve Martin's Man with Two Brains, right? But regardless, the patient would be there and would be awake on the table and would be talking. And what Wilder Penfield would do is insert basically long knitting needles into the brain. The only nerve endings that are that transmit pain to the are in the tumor. And so he could do this without pain. And Wade would kind of go like this, and they'd go, you got it. I'm imagining a kind of a game of battleship, you know, where you're plotting out these points to sort of figure out where that tumor is. The interesting thing that he discovered was that he would poke people in the brain, and they would say things like, I smell burnt toast. I am remembering the way my bedroom looked when I was a boy, you know, growing up. These very intense sensory memories and images, smells, sights. And what he did was he figured out that the parts of the brain do different things. Now, in my family, we think of Wilder Penfield as kind of a hero. I'm sure if you had a brain tumor, you would think so too. Philip K. Dick reads it a little bit differently. Because if we can, in fact, operate someone's brain like a machine, well, that's pretty scary. Imagine yourself watching TV, right? And suddenly you feel this incredible desire to give all of your money to Comcast, right? not a, you know, I need to pay Comcast my bill, but oh my God, paying Comcast this money would be a transcendent, spiritually fulfilling experience for me. This is scary stuff. We'll talk a little bit more about how this works in the book in a minute, but I want you to see a couple of things. Number one, that Phil Dick is kind of paranoid, with good reason. And number two, that he wasn't just making stuff up. that he was aware of this kind of research. He talks about Penfield's work. He knew what Penfield was doing, and he extrapolated out from that a realistic science fiction. Is there a mood organ in our culture today? Yeah. It's called Prozac. And in fact, so many people take it that it shows up in trace amounts in our drinking water. You might not want to think a whole lot about how it gets there, but it does. Now, how is Prozac a mood organ? Well, it doesn't give you exactly the mindset you want, but in some cases it can give you the mindset that you need, right, in order to continue to function. So that's one way of thinking about how this describes our universe, our world. What character, I'm going to go to the next question, excuse me. What character do users see when they merge with their empathy boxes? Anybody remember this one? Wilbur Mercer. Wilbur Mercer, when you watch him, climbs a hill, dies at the top of the hill, descends into the tomb world, and rises again. Does this sound like anybody we know? Right. But he does it not once, which would be, you know, reasonable, but over and over and over and over again. Now, if I had the blackboard behind me, right, I could make kind of a sine wave, right, representing the endless cycle that this represents. Think about the way that Dick is combining, in a very absurd way, Jesus Christ and Sisyphus into one person. Anybody remember who plays Mercer? It's revealed at the end of the novel that he is, in fact, not a religious messiah figure, but a alcoholic B-movie actor from Indiana whose name is Al Jarry. Alfred Jarry was a Dadaist playwright who wrote extremely filthy plays. It's another little joke there. All right, next question. This is the tough one. And this is one I want to talk about a little bit. What is Kipple?
Who's going to stick their neck out?
Yeah, who's willing to? Patrick?
It's junk.
It's junk.
It's stuff.
It's stuff.
It appears overnight.
Yes, it grows. The simple metaphor is that if half of your work desk is clean and half of your work desk is disordered, right? The disordered side seems to grow. More papers get over there, right? I find things moving downward in my inbox. It's a very creepy experience. Now, there's another conversation in which Kipple becomes a word, and it's in The Galactic Pot Healer. There's a conversation. Man says, "Do you like Kipling?" Meaning, do you like the novelist Rudyard Kipling? And the response, because the man doesn't know who Rudyard Kipling is, "I don't know, I've never kippled."
Never gets old.
Yeah, it never does. It's really brilliant. Now, this is a very new insight for me, and I want to be careful to make sure that I explain it. What's happening in that question and answer is that the social framework that gives meaning to the name Rudyard Kipling doesn't exist. It's not shared by the questioner and the answerer. For me, what I believe Dick felt with schizophrenia was in some ways losing our cultural moorings, right? Now, if I say, "What is for whom the bell tolls?" You can say, "Ah, a line from John Donne, a Hemingway novel, a Metallica song," right? But all of those meanings, the significance of that phrase, "for whom the bell tolls," relies on our shared cultural understanding. Schizophrenic doesn't have that. I would argue that Kipple is stuff that no longer means anything to us. It's stuff that is not useful to us because it's part of a social framework that's no longer in existence. And I think that this is a really key, like I said, insight into the way that Dick is thinking about entropy. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Question number four. Is Phil Resch a robot? Or an android, I guess I should say. Phil Resch is this creepy, psychopathic bounty hunter that Deckard meets, who suggests that Deckard should sleep with Rachel and then kill her. It turns out he's not an android. He's passed all the tests. But by this point, you can see the question has really no meaning at all. Because what he's asking about, is he human? No. In some way, the answer is no. On a more inescapable way, the answer is yes. And so, in part, what's happening here is that the definition for human is really kind of being played with. One of the things that's interesting is that Dick's not the first guy to say, what makes us a human, right? You can find that in Shakespeare. But what he does is he changes the equation from being a merely rhetorical question that can never be answered. And by using science fiction, creates some space where you can actually try out some answers. Pretty interesting. What is the rule of life that's laid down by Mercy? This is my toughest question, and it's the extra credit question. Any takers on that one? It's a very difficult one. I usually only get about one student per class. I'd like to read it to you here. It's on page 27. You shall kill only the killers, is the rule of life as laid down by Mercer. I'd like to read the paragraph where that exists. Rick liked to think of him that way. It made his job palatable. In retiring, i.e. killing an Andy, he did not violate the rule of life laid down by Mercer. You shall kill only the killers, Mercer had told them the year empathy boxes first appeared on Earth. And in Mercerism, as it evolved into a full theology, the concept of the killers had grown insidiously. In Mercerism, an absolute evil plucked at the threadbare cloak of the tottering, ascending old man. But it was never clear who or what this evil presence was. A Mercerite sensed evil without understanding it. Put another way, a Mercerite was free to locate the nebulous presence of the killers wherever he saw fit. For Rick Deckard, an escaped humanoid robot, which had killed its master, which had been equipped with an intelligence greater than that of many human beings, which had no regard for animals, which possessed no ability to feel emphatic joy for another life form's success or grief at its defeat, that for him epitomized the killers. I'd like to go through and read two of those sentences and just switch out a couple of words to make it clear what's going on here. Instead of saying a Mercerite sensed evil without understanding it, we would say an American sensed the terrorists without understanding them. Put another way, a American was free to locate the nebulous presence of the terrorists wherever he saw fit. Kind of changes our reading of this. Again, the point is, once you begin to change what qualifies as a human being, your moral compass becomes a lot freer. There's a lot of things that are immoral to do to a human being that are not immoral to do to a cold-hearted Andy-killing machine, right? What kind of animal does Deckard own at the beginning of the novel? Anybody remember this? He owns a sheep at the beginning, and it's an electric sheep. And he tells the story of how he had a real sheep whose name is Groucho. Groucho died when he caught tetanus from the baling wire around his hay. Well, Phil Dick raised sheep in Point Reyes. What you're seeing here in a very subtle thing is Deckard, even when he had a real animal, was a crummy steward for those animals. Couldn't even be bothered to remove a baling wire, right? This gets important. This gets to this guy's character. Deckard wants an animal. I have cats at home that I'm pretty fond of. Well, I'm fond of one more than the other, right? Probably usually the case. But you know, the cats will sit with me and we'll watch TV. Sometimes when I'm sleeping, the cats will snuggle up with me and I get some rewarding pleasure from that. I will admit it. Is that what Deckard wants from his animal? If you remember, he wants to put that animal up on his roof and say, look at me and what I've got. Again, this is a creepy, scary guy. And yet, he's our protagonist. And we're sort of, by the construction of the narrative, forced to be sympathetic to him. It's his mission, we're on it with him. And yet, we can see, whoa, wait a minute, there's a lot going on here. Okay, what I ask my students to do in their essay is to pick a character in the book and show how that character transcends his or her identity. In other words, Rick Deckard is a human being. Now, let's not get into the nerdiest debate of all, which is, in Blade Runner, is he an android or is he a human being? We'll skip that. In the novel, it's clear. He's a person, and it's important that he is a person for the book to work. But when we look at him, it's really easy to see the way he acts like an android. For instance, he wakes up every morning and he programs himself using the mood organ. I'd like to read just another small scene here from the very beginning. Forget what you've scheduled. And I'll forget what I've scheduled, he's arguing with his wife. We'll dial a 104 together and both experience it. And then you stay in it while I reset mine for my usual business-like attitude. That way, I'll want to hop up to the roof and check out the sheep. Now, David, you were talking about Palmer Eldritch being a horror book. That sentence to me is the scariest thing of all. That way, I'll want to go hop up on that roof. Let's change the context and make it clear what's happening here. You're at home with your significant other, right? You put your arm around that person, you look longingly in their eyes. They look at you and they say, maybe I ought to have a couple of beers. That way, I want to be romantic with you. Red flag. My point, right? This is terrifying. Deckard is programming himself to want to do things. It's a very, very scary notion. Notice the book is set over the course of only one day. And Dick is careful to bookend the novel with the Penfield mood organ. The beginning, he needs it to wake up, to get his life in order, to get programmed to do what he needs to do that day. But by the end, let me just read a little bit here. He doesn't need it. Says, Iran says to him at the end of the mission, he comes home. She says, will you go to bed now if I set the mood organ to a 670 setting? Rick responds, what does that bring about? Iran says, long deserved peace. He got to his feet, stood painfully, his face drowsy and confused, as if a legion of battles had ebbed and advanced there over many years. And then, by degrees, he progressed along the route to the bedroom. Okay, he said, long deserved peace. He stretched out on the bed, dust sifting from his clothes and hair onto the white sheets. No need to turn on the mood organ, Iran realized as she pressed the button which made the gray window, made the windows of the bedroom opaque. The gray light of day disappeared. On the bed, Rick, after a moment, slept. He's transcended that programmed identity. It's important to note that the way that he transcended that was through two things. One, suffering. And number two, through a kind of reflection.